The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering iPhone and iPad repairs, including liquid damage, cracked screens, failing batteries, and other issues. More information at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. I'm up here in Colchester, Vermont, outside of Burlington at Vermont Public Radio. We are wandering in the footsteps of Bernie Sanders, presidential candidate, from Brooklyn to Burlington.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? And where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the sides of 12 misty mountains.
A lot of mountains up here in Vermont. Actually, Bernie Sanders has brown eyes, but he grew up in the Bob Dylan protest days in New York City. Born in Brooklyn, you can imagine his voice in the crowds at Woodstock back in the 1960s.
It's a free concert from now on.
Our friends here at Vermont Public Radio have been watching Bernie Sanders for quite a long time. Their radio documentary, Becoming Bernie, traces Bernie's life from his formative years in Brooklyn to the peak of his political career. In those early days, Sanders was just another working-class public high school student in Flatbush, albeit one with a knack for sports. A classmate from Sanders' high school days, Steve Slavin, remembers his old friend from James Madison High as a talented runner with a selfless streak. He remembers a particular race.
Bernie knew that this other guy had not ever won a race by himself. So when they approached the finish line, the other guy reached out to take Bernie's hand, and Bernie sort of just nudged him across the finish line so that the other guy would finish first and Bernie would finish second. And it's a story that this guy has always remembered.
Bernie, the nice guy who finished second. As a college student at the University of Chicago, that independent streak expressed itself academically. Jim Rader, an activist from Chicago and one of Sanders' oldest friends, says his pal didn't really care about grades, but was a voracious reader.
He wasn't a particularly motivated student in terms of classes and that sort of thing. So he spent a lot of time in the library and spent a lot of time reading and read very widely, particularly in politics and social issues.
But there was a moment in 1962 of radical charisma. Bernie Sanders' classmate Robin Kaufman remembers a sit-in and a demonstration in Chicago and a moment when the future could possibly have been predicted.
He was able to convince a bunch of other 19-year-olds that what was going on was something that was wrong, and we had the power and the obligation to try to create change.
From that protest against the university administration in Chicago to this, where Bernie Sanders' political career officially began.
12 votes. Not exactly a landslide victory. However, it appears that we've won. It appears that there's going to be fundamental changes in the city for the low income and the working people.
That's Bernie Sanders announcing his win as mayor of Burlington, Vermont, back in 1981. John Dillon is news director at Vermont Public Radio. He joins me now. What a story. How did Bernie Sanders get from Flatbush, Brooklyn to Vermont?
His political career here began as a third party, you'd almost say fringe candidate, very much a fringe candidate, actually, where he ran with the Liberty Union Party and never got more than 2-4%. He ran for Senate, he ran for governor, and it wasn't until 1980 when he was living in Burlington and a friend of his said, hey, the Liberty Union actually did okay in some of these working class wards in this city. I think you should run for local office. That was his old friend Richard Sugarman, who persuaded him to run for mayor. Bernie, until that point, had never really concerned himself with local issues. He was a big-picture ideologue talking about the Rockefellers, the war in Vietnam, social justice issues on a grand scale. So he ran for mayor. He won almost by a fluke because there was a disaffected Democrat who stole votes from the Democratic incumbent. So that 12-vote victory got whittled down to 10 in a recount, and Bernie Sanders, because of this other race, other candidate in the race, and because the incumbent, who almost had a machine-like control on the city, didn't really campaign, took Sanders for granted, didn't think he was a threat.
Well, of course, he's evolved, and this documentary really tells the story of how he evolved in Vermont. We're talking to John Dillon, news director at Vermont Public Radio. We're going to talk to the governor of Vermont in just a moment. Before we go, John, how has he evolved to become a national figure, do you think, in the few moments we have here?
Well, I think his tenure as mayor really did help him evolve from that ideologue to a pragmatic politician. He had to work with Republicans in his first term because the Democrats didn't want to have anything to do with him. He had ousted one of their own. So he had to cut deals with the Republicans on the city council. He became friends with and an ally with probably the richest real estate developer in the region, whom he appointed as chair of the city police commission. So it helped him become a governing politician as opposed to an outsider agitator.
Steps from mayor, outlier mayor, to representative in Vermont, then senator, and now national political candidate. It's a fascinating story. You can see it at Vermont, hear it at Vermont Public Radio. John Dillon is news director at Vermont Public Radio. Thanks so much, John.
Thank you, John.
Not to spoil the party here, but Vermont Governor Peter Shumlin has been overjoyed to watch Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' campaign gather momentum over the last few months. But the Gov has actually endorsed another slightly less obscure candidate at this point.
I am a Hillary supporter, and I'm incredibly proud of the message she's spreading. And I'll tell you, this is an example of why I support her. One day my phone rings, and Hillary said, "I want to know what you're doing on heroin addiction, because I haven't run for office for 8 years, and I'm out there, and folks keep coming up to me in all walks of life saying, my son, my daughter, my mom, my dad, my neighbor, what are you doing up there?" And then she just listened. And, you know, politicians don't usually do that.
It turns out that Vermont Governor Shumlin considers the presidential campaign something of a sideshow compared with his New Hampshireite neighbors to the east. And that's not because Vermont has no early primary. It's because the problem of heroin he mentioned there has become crisis number one in the Green Mountain State. In 2014, the governor dedicated his entire State of the State address to heroin addiction.
I found myself, you know, I'd be speaking to the Chamber of Commerce annual meeting or to the accountants annual meeting. I'm not the tofu growers of Vermont, but to the all sectors. And folks kept coming up to me afterwards and kind of tugging on my jacket. You know, we're a small state where people talk to the governor and saying things like, you know, I've lost my son. I've lost my daughter. I've lost my mom. Or I would run into small store owners who would say, you know, in a state that has no crime, we're suddenly getting ripped off a lot. Or people would say to me, I had my car broken into and I used to leave my key in it. And I just started asking questions. And I went into prisons. I went into treatment centers. I talked to judges. I talked to prosecutors. I talked to mental health folks. And I realized we had a big problem.
As a substance, what is it that scares you the most about heroin now that you've had so much experience statewide with what it can do socially?
My biggest fear is that we seem to miss in America that we're suffering from this crisis because of the FDA-approved painkillers, OxyContin and others, that we just take a cavalier approach to handing out like candy. And if anyone, no one can deny that that's what's led us into this mess. It's not illegal drugs that got us here. It's not drug dealers coming up and selling this stuff, although it's a problem. It is the fact that we literally prescribe painkillers in this country after the advent of OxyContin with irrational exuberance. There's just no other way to explain it.
Is it the case that in a state like Vermont, people don't see the problem until it's almost too late, that there's a fatality or there's some irreversible consequence that's happened?
I actually think that I, as a governor, got on this one because Vermont faces its challenges, because we have such a great quality of life. We trust each other. We take care of each other. Strangers reach out to strangers. We say hi to each other on the street. We're an incredibly giving, wonderful, taking care of each other kind of people. And when we literally see our neighbors losing their lives or losing everything that they have to addiction, we talk about it. And we say, we got to do something about this. And, you know, when I started talking about this as a governor, it wasn't well received by all. And I think the fact that we have confronted it head on, we've changed the way we deal with this from a crime to a disease, which is exactly what it is.
Are you turning it around?
We will not turn this around until the FDA changes and our friends in Washington and the medical community changes their attitudes about painkillers. We just won't. What we can do is find better ways to deal with the crisis. And that means for Vermont, changing our attitudes, not throwing nonviolent drug addicts into jail, but instead getting them into treatment, getting them wraparound services, getting them back into jobs and back to work. So we literally now in Vermont, if you are an addict and we catch you when you bottom out, the blue lights are on, the handcuffs are on, we say to you, after a third-party assessment to make sure that you're not violent, you're not going to hurt somebody, and that's true with 90%, more than 90% of the folks, if you go into treatment, if you'll do the things that we need you to do, want you to do, and will help you do, you'll never see a judge, you'll never see a criminal record, and you'll never see a prosecutor. Instead, you will get back and become a productive member of our society. And until, as long as we're going to pass this painkillers out, we're going to have to start dealing it like with as the healthcare crisis that it is, and it is a healthcare problem. It's not a law enforcement problem.
What do pharmacists, small business people in Vermont say about their role here? Do they say, hey, leave me alone, I'm a free businessman, well, not my problem, no, I'm making a profit here, this is how I make a living?
They've actually been very helpful. They really have. And, you know, we're actually making progress on the pharmacy problem. In other words, we've set up the Northeast Governor's regional databases that allow us to know when someone is pill shopping and crossing state borders or doing it within the state. We've become much better about linking law enforcement to those prescribing practices without invading anybody's privacy. All that's working pretty well. The problem we have is that when we drive people away from the pills, they go to the cheaper form of heroin. And get the math on this one. You can buy a bag of heroin, pure heroin, in parts south of Vermont for $5, $6 a bag. You can sell this poison up here for $20, even $30 a bag. So you can see the financial incentive for folks to come and peddle this poison in Vermont. We're obviously having a statewide conversation about changing attitudes about this disease. But the root is that if we don't change our approach to pain killers and the way we pass them out, we're going to be signing up more heroin addicts.
Governor Shumlin, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Peter Shumlin is the Democratic governor of Vermont. Later this hour, we'll hear from Bernie Sanders' older brother, Larry, about the early days and about Larry's reaction to his brother's campaign. Also, a social experiment. One community in Miami is thinking about getting rid of its police altogether. How would that work in your town? From Ellsworth, Wisconsin, I grew up in the country. My hometown was unincorporated and did not have any cops, just county deputies and casino security. Everything was fine.
Hello, my name is Kareem Johnson. I'm a former city councilman from Coatesville, Pennsylvania. And due to some budget issues that we had in the city, we had to consider the possibility of reducing our police force. There was a large community outcry, and the people were unwilling to sacrifice having a police department or even considering a reduction.
By necessity or voluntarily, how would your community be different if there were no police? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. More about this later this hour. That crash of a Russian airliner in the Sinai Peninsula on Saturday that left 224 people dead is looking more and more like some kind of terrorist attack, according to some investigators. The Airbus jetliner at cruising altitude bursts into flames, breaks up and falls to earth suddenly.
And you, Putin the pig, if you think you can destroy our state by sending your planes, vehicles, and soldiers, you are wrong, and you will regret that. The plane we downed is the best proof. We will not be satisfied with downing your planes, but will storm your houses and will slaughter you.
That's reportedly a statement from ISIS insurgents in Sinai released earlier this week. But the evidence so far is circumstantial, not substantive. James Clapper, director of U.S. National Intelligence, said yesterday, quote, "There is a very aggressive ISIL chapter in the Sinai, but we really don't know." The British government yesterday announced that it believes an explosive device likely took down the plane and suspended all flights between the UK and Sharm el-Sheikh, the resort community in Sinai where the flight originated. A number of European nations have followed suit. The UK's announcements disrupted the mood of talks between Egypt's president and Prime Minister David Cameron today, according to Edward Lucas, senior editor at The Economist and author of Cyberphobia, Identity, Trust, Security, and the Internet.
Well, it's obviously politically really sensitive for relations with Egypt, first of all. We actually have Mr. Sisi visiting London right now, and it was on the eve of his visit that we've delivered a really savage blow to the international confidence in Egypt's tourism industry. Its tourism really keeps the Egyptian economy afloat to a large extent, and everyone's going to be thinking twice if they've got holidays planned or pending there. So it's a very big deal to say that Egypt is not able to guarantee the security of outgoing flights if someone really did put a bomb on the board. We don't know what the lead was that has made the British government take what they stress is a temporary measure. But if it is a bomb, then that is a big black mark against Egyptian security, because that bomb must have been put on the plane in an Egyptian airport, which clearly wasn't following proper security procedures.
And the fact that this is a huge economic blow to Egypt only underscores certainly the motive, if not the opportunity, for the insurgents in Sinai to take a step like this. They know exactly the kind of damage they can do if they were behind it, right?
Yes, it's a double weapon for them, because they both want to demonstrate their ability to fight back against the Egyptian regime, as they see it, but they also detest the kind of sybaritic bacchanalian pleasures of Sharm el-Sheikh, which is run like a kind of Western holiday resort with mingling between the sexes, there's drinking. It goes down very badly with conservative Muslims, let alone Islamists.
Oh, that's fascinating. I hadn't really thought of that. You know, there's a long tradition, or a tradition in any case, of this kind of denial of reality, or what seems to be reality, by the Egyptians. The Egypt Air crash, which was designated by aviation experts as an obvious suicide by the pilot, to this day, the Egyptian government has not acknowledged that there could have possibly been any deliberate pilot attempt to bring down that Egypt airplane that took place some years ago. This is something the Egyptian government typically does to protect tourism and to save face, wouldn't you say?
Well, I think all governments are reluctant to admit that they've fallen down and they don't like seeing their countries as vulnerable. But of course, Egypt is a pretty closed authoritarian society. You don't get the kind of open investigation there. And of course, the other thing is Egypt is a powder keg. There is a large slice of the Egyptian population which loathes this kind of secular military authoritarian democracy. They want to have a proper, as they see it, pious Islamist government.
Looking at the U.S. side of this, do you folks over at The Economist believe that the United States, which has declared that it also has concerns about the airspace over Sinai, but is distancing itself from the claims of the UK government here, is basically appeasing the dictatorship in Cairo at the expense of the truth by not endorsing what the investigators in the UK are saying?
It's not only America that's being cautious. Other European countries, who far more than America send tourists to Egyptian holiday resorts, are also being cautious. For America, this is not that big a deal, because there are very few Americans probably who would go that far to get some winter sunshine. But ultimately, once they investigate the wreckage, and that's coming pretty soon now, there's going to be marks of explosives or not. And if there are explosives there, then that is a bomb, and the bomb must have been planted on the aircraft. And that means flying out of that aircraft out of that airport is going to be seen as unsafe until things change. Either Britain's going to back down and say, we're now reassured it wasn't a bomb, or other countries are going to say, well, it was a bomb, and we join Britain in saying, sorry, we can't put our own people's lives at risk by having them fly in and out of this place.
Edward Lucas, your suspicion, if this assessment proves out to be true, is this a strategic escalation by ISIS against Egypt, or an opportunistic attack by a local insurgency in Sinai?
My guess is that it's an escalation by ISIS, that aircraft are incredible points of vulnerability, and we've seen aircraft can be shot down at 30,000 feet if you've got the right missile, but the best way of blowing up an aircraft is to put a bomb on it, either with a person or without. We've got better at screening people as they get onto planes with weapons and bombs and all the rest of it, but the baggage is still really vulnerable, and any weakness at the airport can lead to a bag being switched, being interfered with. The way aviation works doesn't make it easy to have this sort of security. You have to put a lot of effort into it. And in a country where there's a lot of ill-paid and very resentful people, it's going to be a tempting target for ISIS to have a Gurdon airplane with Westerners on board, or Europeans on board.
Well, Edward Lucas, senior editor at The Economist, you're making me feel better about driving home from Vermont rather than flying, even though I'm probably more in danger on the roads than I would be in the air. Edward Lucas, thanks so much.
My pleasure, John.
Edward Lucas is senior editor at The Economist and author of Cyberphobia, Identity, Trust, Security, and the Internet. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry from Vermont Public Radio. One more thought on cybersecurity. I'm an open-minded guy. I don't mind being judged. The negative comments at thetakeaway.org don't bother me. But when my computer judges me, hate that. I'm making a password for myself and the computer says weak or pretty good or not bad. Hey, it's my password. You make it. I've actually screamed this at the computer. It turns out there's an 11-year-old, Mira Modi, who can help. She launched a tech startup called Diceware that makes cryptographically smart passwords for $2 a pop.
Diceware is a way of making strong, secure passwords that's hard for the computer to break, but it's easy for you to remember.
Diceware uses a classic randomization technique where rolls of dice with letters and words produce secure combinations. Mira's mom, Julia Angwin, is now struggling to keep up with her precocious sixth grader. For a while, she thought she was ahead of the game. She's an investigative reporter at ProPublica and author of Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. Relentless 11-year-olds.
I wasn't sure I wanted to do it, but Mira was really committed, and she came up with like how she wanted to do it and how she wrote all these little templates of how she would make the passwords, and she showed me how she wanted to design the website. So I said, fine, we did it, and we put it up, but I didn't think that it would take off.
Tell me a little bit about Diceware and why you started it.
Well, my mom was working on her book, and she discovered this method called Diceware, and I started doing it when she wanted to try out the method herself. And since it took quite a while to make a password, she asked me to make passwords for her, so I started doing it. And then I started doing it for more people, but it wasn't like now where it's like I do it a lot. It's just like a kind of side thing.
Right, and you didn't charge in the beginning, right?
No, I did charge, but it was not as much.
Really?
It was like a dollar.
Ah, really? No kidding. Well, that's fantastic. Give me an example of a string of characters that's hard to decrypt, but
okay,
easy
so,
to remember.
This is the one I used on my website. It's Alger, K-L-M, Blonde, Puck Horse.
Alger, K-L-M, Blonde,
Puck Horse.
I mean, that's like, I heard it once and I almost remembered like the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's like it tells a story. That's really brilliant. So how much have you made in this little business?
Well, I've gotten about 900 orders, but I've only completed about half of them or one third of them because of school and all the other things I'm doing.
Right. All the things that CEOs typically have to do. Julia, what do you think of your daughter's decision to leap from helping you out with your book to actually starting a business?
Well, to be honest, it surprised me. I was really happy to pay her a dollar to make my passwords because I thought I was getting a great deal. And then she, you know, did it for friends and family. But when she asked me this summer if she could put it online, I was kind of reluctant. I mean, the truth is I write about privacy issues, and so the idea of my 11-year-old having this sort of digital identity and digital business wasn't what I wanted.
Now, Mira, would you say your mom is reasonable and rational about this, or is she a little bit paranoid?
I thought she was going to be really mad because she's never let me put any real name up, any, like, pictures of me and stuff, and so I was surprised when she was like, okay, we'll try it. And I don't think she really expected it, like, to go off this big. But I think she thought she'd have to, like, manage it all herself, like, making sure I actually did it, but I actually do it, so.
I was worried that it was, like, going to be that. And truthfully, I have actually, obviously, rolled dice and helped her with passwords, but she's really running it on her own.
Well, Julia Angwin and Mira Modi, thank you so, so much, and good luck with Diceware.
Thanks.
And Julia, good luck filling out your IRS forms this year.
Yes, thank you.
Mira Modi is the 11-year-old founder of the password-generating company Diceware. Julia Angwin is her mother, as well as the author of Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. A community without police? Whoa, what do we think about that? Portland, Oregon. The short-term effect of the removal of the police would be more crime, there's no doubt. But 10 years down the line, I believe we would see vast improvements in safety due to public policing of neighborhoods. More investment means more engagement.
This is Tim from Illinois. Without herders, the sheep would be devoured by the wolves. I've been in law enforcement for nearly 30 years, and I challenge anyone to deal with the 10% of society that we continually deal with, and then think for 1 second that we can do without police.
Key West, Florida says, I think anything can work if a community truly comes together.
This is Debbie in Clearwater, Florida. I can't imagine it. I live in Florida. Everyone would be shooting each other for silly things like cutting each other off in traffic or using a cell phone to check on one's child while on a movie date with your spouse. Oh, wait a minute. That already happens. Never mind.
Associate Professor of Politics George Ciccarello Marr at Drexel University in Philadelphia has given this a lot of thought. It's about the healthy questioning of assumptions, he says, asking why do we have so many police? Are we sure we need all of them? And what would society look like without them?
What's clear is that a society without police would look radically different from the society that we have today, in part because it simply would not be the kind of unequal society, the society divided by great socioeconomic disparity and by racism that we live in today, because the police emerge precisely to deal with and to control those kind of divisions in society historically.
That's a casting of the police as being, in some sense, artifacts from the Jim Crow era who are enforcing an ideology and an approach to racial groups and minorities that results in violence. And you've talked about that in the past. Do you think America is over-policed, or is it just certain communities are over-policed?
Globally speaking, it's undeniable that we use the police in this country in a way that is unthinkable in most places. So, while we may understand it to be natural, as many people have pointed out, even in Europe, it would not be understood to be natural. But the reality is, as you point out correctly, it is specific populations. And this aids in the naturalization because we don't think of ourselves as over-policed if we, say, in a white suburb, always see the police and feel relief and feel comfort. But specifically, those communities that are subject to the most police scrutiny and police violence are those in which the natural response to seeing the police is not going to be comfort. It's not going to be relief.
Can you get deeper into this question of what it would look like to have no police? Because I think a lot of people listening to this conversation would say, no police, that's ridiculous. You can't go there. It's a complete absurdity and a waste of time to even talk about. Why do you think that's not the case?
Well, I think the task is certainly a daunting one. There's no way around that. And especially because, as the saying goes, when you've got a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And so when you're as accustomed to using the police as the solution as we are, it's very difficult to think differently. And part of the task is to think a little differently. We can do that by limiting and abolishing fraternal orders of police. It involves limiting those legislative elements, for example, the police bills of rights that make it difficult to even find out the names of police involved in brutality incidents. And it also involves looking at experiments and looking at different forms of how to maintain and uphold societies that we can see in other parts of the world, and even in these experiments as we're talking about in Miami. You've got communities, and a lot of people will say, what do we do in dangerous communities? What do we do in communities that suffer an absence of social fabric? And what you find globally is that it's actually most often in these kind of communities where the community gets together and says, we've had enough, the police are not keeping us safe, we are going to do that ourselves. And so you
have
these experiments.
What's an example of that, though, in the United States or around the world where that's worked successfully?
There are communities that I can think of in Mexico, in Venezuela, which is a specialty of mine, where community members in communities long suffering not only police violence but also drug violence got together and removed the police from their community and those involved in the drug trade, and began to organize their lives in a more collective and more democratic manner. And these are only small experiments, of course, but I can say that I've lived in and I've spent time in communities in which there were no police, and I felt much more safe than I would be in neighboring communities that had the police, but that had very little social cohesion, that had very little participation of the community in making sure that everyone is safe.
In North Philadelphia, George, is there a way of doing this in collaboration with police, or does it have to be a we'll take control of our security in opposition to the current police administration?
I think it would be very difficult. And the reason is that the police, and here you almost want to feel a little sympathetic because they're sort of thrown out there to solve a problem that they didn't themselves create. In other words, the social degradation of poor communities, of communities of color in this country. And the tools that they're given to do that are really very, very limited. And they always almost inevitably involve, if not violence, then incarceration. And the point is here that incarceration is destructive of the community, that it is violence toward the community that does not fix anything. It actually makes these problems much worse in the long run. And so unless there's a way to devise a really radically different role for the police that is centered around de-escalation, that is not centered around the use of force, then it would be very difficult to imagine anything changing with the police firmly in control.
But how do you make that argument to someone in uniform? That could be an African-American cop who wants to keep his job and actually believes that he's serving a purpose in a community of color that does have serious problems, as you say, with social fabric and, violence.
I think the first step is to understand that while that person may understand themselves to be a trained specialist in policing and security, that real community self-control is a much more radically democratic affair. In other words, that person would need to understand that he needs to sit down with the community, ideally with their own community, and begin to participate in decision-making about how that control takes place. Anytime you're talking about abolishing an institution that's so central to the functioning of a country, you're talking about a long conversation with many, many steps and many elements. And yet it's precisely because of the centrality that the police play in this country that even the smallest of changes can bring dramatic impact.
George Giacarello-Marr is Associate Professor of Politics at Drexel University. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
This is Bill Herbert from Portland, Oregon. My community without cops, that would look like the Wild West with everybody caring. That's what the NRA would prefer, and I say no to that.
Hi, it's Kate from Silicon Valley. No cops here? No way. A predatory element would probably take over.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like Russian, retirement planning, and rock climbing. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at curious.com/PRI.
If you think of the name Larry Sanders, perhaps what comes to mind is that old HBO TV show starring Gary Shandling, Jeffrey Tambor, and Rip Torn.
Frankly, I'll tell you the truth.
Wait a minute. Are you telling me that when you do this, that isn't the same affectation? That isn't the same as my, hey now!
There, you just said it again. And, you know, I asked you not to say it.
Lord knows what the success of that show did to the soft-spoken privacy and quiet life of Larry Sanders, the older brother of candidate Bernie Sanders. Larry has lived in Oxford, England since 1969, where he was a professor of social administration. He's dabbled in local government in the UK. He clearly loves and is proud of his little brother's success. And he has bitter, sad memories of losing his parents in New York when Larry and Bernie were just starting out in life. Larry, you see, is Bernie's only sibling, and has fond memories of their childhood growing up in Brooklyn, New York, where he says Roosevelt, Brooklyn Dodgers, and corned beef and pastrami sandwiches ruled. Senator Sanders gives credit to his big brother for introducing him to ideas that helped shape his political future. Growing up in New York at that time, the two of them were part of the post-World War II Jewish radicalism tradition and the Beat Movement. But they were faces in the crowd in the beginning, says Larry, not leading the rallies.
We did grow up in all that, although it wasn't high-powered cultural environment. It was a very homely environment. It was an environment, after all, of immigrants and the children of immigrants. But it was a very comfortable life in many ways. Everything we needed was at hand. The street was free and easy and safe. But we were out there in the afternoons. We played every kind of ball game I think ever invented. I don't know where they came from.
Bernie was good at basketball.
Bernie was good at all sports. He was basically a very good athlete. He loved basketball. He was 6'1". That was not tall enough.
Not tall enough?
No.
Politics back then?
Politics, the family was staunch New Deal. like everybody else in
so
my
Roosevelt
area in Brooklyn.
Rules. Roosevelt rules.
Roosevelt absolutely ruled. There were fewer. Somebody said there were fewer Republicans in our neighborhood than there were Yankee fans. And there were very few of those.
So you were Brooklyn Dodgers.
We were Brooklyn Dodgers.
Tough Brooklyn kid?
I wouldn't say tough. What would be the right word? I mean, we didn't fight a lot. We did fight occasionally with our friends. We were independent Brooklyn kids.
He's very nice to Hillary up there during the debate.
We were not attackers. We weren't pacifists, but we were not attackers.
Did Bernie ever suggest or say, when I grow up, I want to be president?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. There was no glimmer of a thought. President, I don't think senator, I don't think member of the House of Representatives would have been in the discussion.
First violinist, basketball star, what did he aspire to that you can recall?
See, that's reflecting back on what I said a few minutes ago, we were not in that stage of middle-class development where people are talking to their children about what they could aspire to, and children are building on that. And we didn't have those kind of models. We had successful business people in the family. We had unsuccessful business people in the family. Going to college was very easy in a sense. It was, you know, it was very good education, very easily available, very cheap. And the family was not against, you know, it was thought it was a normal progression. But clarity about professions, about futures, just we didn't talk about that.
Can you recall a politically transformative moment for Bernie or for your family, in the early days?
Well, of course, politically transformative, as my father began to get information about his family, they all were gobbled up with their children, all disappeared, and we began to get that information. So that, it was funny, it wasn't much discussed.
The Holocaust?
The Holocaust.
Gobbled up in the Holocaust.
Gobbled up in the Holocaust.
That's a euphemism.
That's murdered, yes. Yeah.
Bernie got involved in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee when he was in Chicago. How do you think Chicago changed him or energized him?
I think Chicago was a turning point. He had the upbringing, he had the basic ideas, the basic values, but Chicago was the place where everything hit him in the face very hard. He was old enough to be involved. It was a situation which called on people, and he answered the situation. And I think that that did change his life.
Is there a place in Chicago, in an office, a person in Chicago who is particularly meaningful, do you think?
He earned on the streets and in the stacks of the library. He didn't learn much in class from what we talked about. But he read voraciously in the library, and then he worked avidly on the streets when he got involved in the civil rights stuff. And he in that, he was not a halfway person.
Explore that. He was not a halfway person. What does that mean?
Well, he was a cross-country runner. Do you know what cross-country runners do?
I sure do.
They go up and down through the mud, and the good ones don't give up. And Bernard had that tenacity from such an early age. And I think when he got involved in civil rights, it was his job to take part in writing it. And he was going to do that with all his soul.
So in the middle of his Chicago civil rights experience, his parents passed away.
Our mother died actually just while he was in the year at Brooklyn. And I think also the reason why he wanted to get away from Brooklyn, because things were very painful.
So he had to be his own guide.
He was very much his own guy.
Does that explain anything about what you see and hear when he's up on the podium giving a speech?
I think that's a very good question. Not so much in the podium, in some of those famous congressional hearings when he would lambast important people in a way that very few politicians have the nerve to do. There is a capacity for Bernie to stand on his own against the world, and I think a lot of the power he has as a politician comes from that.
When you hear his speeches, is that the familiar Bernie that you hear, or is that a new retooled Bernie for the White House?
The issues are all the same. So he's not a new Bernard. The tone is different as he's become aware that he actually could be president.
How have you felt?
I have felt his feeling of success. I felt it in his voice as he spoke. And I began to look at what was happening and seeing where Bernard stood and began to try to put it into a kind of world history. And I see him as a potential great president.
Is it exciting?
I tend to cry at this kind of point. I don't know if it's not excitement, you know, like it is very deep. It's a very deep feeling.
And you're the older brother.
Mm.
He'll need you.
Well, I'll be with him.
You'll be Secretary of Older Brothers. Secretary of Older Brothers.
I'll be Secretary of Older Brothers, definitely.
Why do you cry at moments like this?
I just think it brings up thought of family.
What your parents might have thought.
Exactly. They would have been so happy.
So proud.
So, yes.
Well, go Bernie.
Absolutely.
Go Bernie. Larry, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Oh, thank you. That was very interesting.
Larry Sanders is the proud older brother of presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. Here's something to take with you today. Rear Admiral Peter J. Clark has become the 16th commander at the Guantanamo Bay detention facility. According to veteran Gitmo reporter Carol Rosenberg at the Miami Herald, Clark quietly took the reins earlier this week at the facility we've been told since before 2008 is either trying people unconstitutionally in military tribunals, the Supreme Court has said that, or is going to close. President Obama has said that. 112 prisoners remain in detention at Guantanamo Bay. We always want to hear from you. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave a comment on our website, thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks so much to the folks at Vermont Public Radio. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.